Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle, a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. In the previous episode, we looked at the history of humanity's use of mercury up to the present, detailing the advantageous properties and known risks of working with this intriguing metal. Modern science has learned that organic compounds of mercury can form in aquatic environments, presenting a danger to human health. To better understand how this all works, we now turn our attention to the two other players in our story, water and Wisconsin. Human cultures have historically defined themselves, at least in part, by their access or lack of access to water, and the development of Wisconsin has been no exception. Given its physical and cultural geography, Wisconsin provides an ideal opportunity to demonstrate the complexities and challenges of understanding and managing mercury as it interacts with water in the larger environment, and it will be the focus of this episode. Water Shapes the Land, the Making of Wisconsin.
The finest workers in stone are not copper or steel tools, but the gentle touches of air and water working at their leisure, with a liberal allowance of time. Henry David Thoreau.
Geographers and environmental historians often begin their description of Wisconsin at the close of the last ice age around 10,000 years ago. The great Laurentide ice sheet still covered the northern and eastern portions of the state. What parts that remained free from ice were the home of mighty mammoth and mastodon, and the small bands of Paleo-Indians who hunted them. The glaciers soon began their final retreat, leaving the marks of their long and tortured progress over vast parts of the state. Only the driftless area in the southwest corner of the state bears no signs of ever being glaciated. As the massive ice melted, the land itself, depressed into the Earth's crust from the weight of the frozen water, began to rise. The Great Lakes formed, and the Wisconsin landscape as we know it stabilized around 8,000 years ago. Water shaped this land in two principal ways. The action of water as ice deposited large ridges of gravel and debris on the edge of glaciers. Known as moraines, these ridges are found in the north and east of the state. Also left behind by the glaciers were long thin hills called drumlins, and what is called collapsed till topography, where random rocks and sand trapped in glaciers settled to the ground when the ice melted. This helped create the uneven rolling hills and till plains of the region. Running meltwater, the second major shaper of the area, left long, winding hills of sediment called eskers and great plains of outwash. Sometimes this outwash would bury large chunks of ice that took longer to melt, causing depressions where the sand collapsed. Known as collapsed outwash topography, the most striking referred to as kettles, these frequently filled with water and formed most of Wisconsin's many inland lakes. Meltwater rushing from draining glacial lakes and melting ice sheets frequently cut sharp gorges into the land, called dells. Some of these must have been quite sudden and dramatic, as when the moraine that had dammed Glacial Lake, Wisconsin broke, causing a mega flood that created the well-known Wisconsin Dells. Thus, a rocky and irregular landscape was created, carved by ice and piled with remnants of its passing. So where is this landscape exactly? Well, if you were able to look down from space upon North America, the Great Lakes, often called the Inland Seas, would be easy to spot due to their size and brilliant blue color. Tucked between Lake Michigan in the east and Lake Superior on the north, you would quickly be able to locate the land area now known as Wisconsin. It is in great part delineated physically by water. Now, if you started in Dubuque, Iowa, which is on the shores of the Mississippi River, about 1,000 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, headed north about 200 miles and forked up another 100 miles of the St. Croix River, you would trace almost the entire western border. Take a short northward jump from the headwaters of the St. Croix to the end of the St. Louis River, and the border reaches the westernmost tip of Lake Superior.
The big lake they call Gitche-Gumee.
The official northern border actually heads out into Lake Superior itself, encompassing the Apostle Islands, continues about 100 miles to the east, and comes ashore at the mouth of the Montreal River. This border then follows the Montreal up almost 40 miles, not quite reaching its headwaters in Pine Lake, instead turning for an arbitrary straight run through the hilly and forested lake country so typical of northern Wisconsin. It meets the headwaters of yet another river, the Brule, and follows that into the Menominee River. From there, the Menominee is the border, flowing down into Green Bay, which is an estuary of Lake Michigan. This boundary, which gives Michigan jurisdiction over the Upper Peninsula, is the result of an odd bit of long-ago political horse trading, when that original part of the Michigan Territory was ceded to the newly forming state of Michigan in exchange for giving up claims to Toledo, Ohio. Who got the better deal will be left for the listener to decide. The Wisconsin border continues to chart a watery course up the middle of Green Bay, through the Rock Island Passage, and west into Lake Michigan proper. Now heading due south, this eastern border is considered to follow the center of Lake Michigan. This comprises the entire eastern boundary. Around 30 miles north of Chicago, the border turns west and finally comes ashore south of Kenosha, Wisconsin. Carrying on straight west another 160 miles over the flatter southern plains, the border finally meets back up with the Mississippi River near Dubuque. Looking about 35 miles north of Dubuque, you might also see the Wisconsin River where it reaches the Mississippi, after bisecting almost the entire state, from the north near Michigan to the southwest. The Wisconsin River has itself often been a political boundary over the years. Another important water feature is Wisconsin's largest lake, Winnebago, centrally located about 40 miles east of Lake Michigan. Another major river, the Fox, flows north into and out of this lake, finally ending at Green Bay, which is visible as a large inlet on the eastern coast. Wisconsin has an additional 15,000 plus lakes and at least 13,500 miles of navigable streams and rivers. Nearly one-third of prehistoric post-glacial Wisconsin was wetlands, though nearly half of the estimated 16,000 square miles of pre-settlement wetlands have been lost. Of the 65,000 square miles that comprise Wisconsin today, watery acreage in some form accounts for around 15% of that total. With this much water, it is easy to see why water issues continue to be so important for the state's future. Certainly, water was a principal determinant in shaping the events and development of the state in the past.
Rivers are roads which move and which carry us whither we desire to go. Blaise Pascal.
For thousands of years, native peoples hunted, fished, and raised water-intensive crops such as cranberries and wild rice in favorable parts of the region. Many of these tribes still live in ancestral lands here today. Place names all over the state bear witness to their presence, even down to the name Wisconsin itself, though the origins of this possibly Algonquin-derived state name have been obscured over time. Waterways provided convenient transportation for Native Americans, French fur trappers, and their descendants, the Métis people. Later on, British and Yankee soldiers, as well as newly arrived German, English, and Scandinavian settlers set up villages, forts, and trading posts along traversable rivers. As more permanent settlements took root, these river towns shaped the eventual industrial growth of Wisconsin. In the 1830s before statehood, everything northwest of the Wisconsin River was still Indian country, and to this day, most of the population and industry of the region remains concentrated in the lower southeast. By 1848, when Wisconsin became a state, water had already become central to industrial processes, essential for the many sawmills that had sprung up around the state to process timber, and also the breweries which had begun to make the lager beer which would make Milwaukee famous. Here's Kim Murata, Vice President of Corporate Social Responsibility, MillerCoors.
Water obviously played a very significant part in the founding of MillerCoors and in Frederick Miller's decision to actually move to Milwaukee. A lot of German immigrants lived here, and a lot of breweries then subsequently came to Milwaukee into this area. He moved in 1855, and he purchased the Plank Road Brewery for about $2,300. And that Plank Road Brewery is still here today, the oldest still functioning major brewery in the U.S. It's located in the Menominee Valley in the heart of the city of Milwaukee. And one of the greatest parts about that location is it provided easy access to fresh water from Lake Michigan and the surrounding lakes. But he moved here not only because of the lakes and the fresh water, but also because of the temperature. He built caves in the Menominee Valley, and the caves were really important in this environment because they could take the snow from the winter months, pack it into the caves, and then place the beer in there. And it helped keep the beer cold through the spring and the summer and the fall months until the next snowfall in the winter. Also, with the rivers, he was able to ship a lot of raw materials to the breweries and then use the lakes and the rivers to actually ship beer out of the breweries. So water was really key back in 1855 and still remains very important to us MillerCoors here in 2010.
Also in Milwaukee, great iron foundries and blast furnaces drew on the waters of the Milwaukee River to cool their metal and then used Lake Michigan to ship their products. Cement factories prospered briefly as well, and all of these industries depended on water. By 1889, water wheels provided one-third of the mechanical power in Wisconsin, and steam provided the rest. Until the advent of electricity, factories were inevitably tied to water resources. The great story in the development of Wisconsin during the late 1800s, however, was timber. Timber was also initially tied to the rivers and lakes of Wisconsin. This was the age of the great cut and run. Loggers went up the river valleys, sawed down the primeval groves of white pine that had grown up since the Ice Age, and floated them down the rivers. Starting in 1870, these forests were systematically clear-cut, and little thought was given to preserving this valuable and finite natural resource. When Wisconsin's high-quality timber finally played out around the start of World War I, paper production, using wood pulp from less desirable trees and plenty of water, became the prominent industry along rivers such as the Fox, the Wisconsin, and the Chippewa. The lower Fox River today still boasts the world's highest concentration of paper mills. Though Wisconsin would establish itself as a major manufacturer of paper products, its rivers would eventually pay a steep environmental price for this prosperity, as these industries discharged many toxic chemicals into the state's waters for many years. As Wisconsin's population expanded in the 20th century, the cities and towns continued to follow the development patterns initially imposed by the need of industry for plentiful water access. By 1915, though, a new power option, electricity, was already providing 38% of the power for Wisconsin industry. No longer would factories be tied to water supply. Convenient and reliable, relatively clean and quiet, electrical generation would increase with every coal-fired plant that came online from the 1940s through the 1980s. These plants were foundational in maintaining the high levels of productivity and ensuing higher standards of living that would characterize the American experience in the 1900s. By the 1970s, nuclear power was added to the mix, with two sites providing electricity to the state as well. However, as both of these types of power generation require enormous quantities of water, around 6 billion gallons a day at present, the pattern of plants being built on rivers and lakes was again followed. Electricity is essential to modern culture, but every source used for energy does have its downsides, and it always seems to take a while for society to identify and effectively deal with the challenges that inevitably arise with new technologies. Though plentiful and inexpensive, Wisconsinites would find that coal too would have its cost, because coal plants became the major source of mercury emissions in the state. By the mid-20th century, Wisconsin began to see the consequences of 100 years of relentless exploitation of its natural resources. The complete cutover of its old-growth forests, extensive soil erosion, the extinction of its vast flocks of passenger pigeons, and precipitous decline in many other species, air quality issues in urban areas, and the serious pollution of many of its most important rivers by paper mills and other industries. Perhaps in response to this, the state became a leader in the conservation movement in the 1950s and 60s, when new ways of thinking about the world began to gain political traction, though one can find protests and proclamations against environmental outrages beginning early in the state's history. Listen to this description from the Evening Wisconsin newspaper of the dubious quality of Milwaukee river water in 1879.
A decoction of uncertain proportions of Milwaukee River, Milwaukee sewage, Menominee Marsh, slaughterhouses, breweries, and tanneries.
91 years after this was published, the very first Earth Day was founded on April 22, 1970, by Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. This is often considered the birth of the modern environmental movement.
The crowd heard calls for revolution, calls for working within the system. Earth Day's founder and co-sponsor, Senator Gaylord Nelson, offered a more specific plan.
We'll elect an ecology Congress as the 92nd Congress, a Congress that will build bridges between our citizens and between men and nature's systems. Environment is all of America and its problems.
Soon after, the Federal Clean Water Act in 1972 set in motion comprehensive efforts to reduce water pollution and its sources. As a result, Wisconsin's rivers, lakes, and wetlands began a slow and continuing recovery. Practices were put in place to monitor and maintain the health of regional waters, and it would be these investigations that would uncover the sources that had been silently introducing mercury into state waters for decades. But before returning to examine the mercury cycle, it is important to establish a clear picture of the hydrologic cycle. Wisconsin's interconnected water cycle consists of precipitation in the form of rain, snow, and water vapor, surface water in rivers, streams, lakes, and wetlands, and groundwater. About 30 to 34 inches of water falls from the atmosphere each year on Wisconsin, and about 18 to 25 inches of this either evaporates or gets transpired by plants back into the sky. The remainder becomes surface water or seeps into the ground. The amount of precipitation can vary significantly in different areas of the state, with the northern parts generally getting considerably more snow. A great variety is also found among the many lakes of the region, ranging from tiny ponds to mighty Lake Winnebago, which is 30 miles long and 10 miles wide, as well as the two immense Great Lakes of Superior in Michigan. The surrounding area and the size of its population, as well as the physical inflow and outflow of waters connected to it, can all greatly influence the quality of any particular lake's water. This makes them difficult to easily categorize. Here's Alfred House from the Advisory Committee for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant and the Apostle Islands Sports Fishermen Association.
I think what many people don't realize about Lake Superior and the hydrologic cycle is the length of time it takes water to outflow from this lake. Water that during the War of 1812 might have been flowing down the Brule River into Lake Superior, it doesn't leave Lake Superior theoretically until this year. And what that means, you know, you've got water that takes 200 years to roll over in this lake. What we put in it now is going to be around for a long time for both us and our children and our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And I think we all need to focus on that and understand we need to put as little into it as possible as far as contamination and pollution.
The latest satellite and mapping technology reveals that nearly 85,000 miles of flowing surface water join Wisconsin to the Mississippi River Basin and the Great Lakes. Many factors affect the water quality of these rivers and streams. Surrounding land use and land cover, the size and topography of the individual watershed, whether the water source is from groundwater, lake, wetlands, or precipitation, the amount of water, and the gradient that determines its overland speed. All these things contribute to the dynamic nature of flowing water. Another key component of Wisconsin's hydrologic cycle is wetlands. Ranging from the Great Horicon Marsh in the east, at 32,000 acres, the largest freshwater cattail marsh in the United States, to the vast fens and bogs of the north. Be they hardwood swamp, wet meadow, or lake shoreline, wetlands provide critical habitat for wildlife, flood control, and shoreline protection. As water slows when it moves through wetlands, the sediments and pollutants settle in what amounts to a natural water filtration system. The water source and soil type at a location all influence the formation and eventual shape of wetland, so they are as varied as the other types of water you will find in Wisconsin. These environments combine aquatic and terrestrial habitat, are rich in biodiversity, and are vital for the greater ecosystems to which they belong. The final element of this interconnected water system is what has been frequently referred to as Wisconsin's buried treasure, groundwater. Contained within four major aquifers, this groundwater is estimated to exceed 1.2 quadrillion gallons. Keep in mind that an aquifer is not a huge underground lake, but rather a layer of permeable rock or soil that can store or transmit water. If you could look at a cross-section of Wisconsin beneath the ground, you would find that, in terms of the aquifers, it resembles a lopsided layer cake baked by an amateur chef. Underlying everything is a massive bottom layer of ancient crystalline bedrock at an average depth of 800 to 1,000 feet. For most of the rest of the state, except the central north, a sandstone aquifer rests atop this, consisting of alternating layers of sandstone and dolomite, a mineral similar to limestone. In the east of the state, a separate aquifer of more porous dolomite, edged by shale, pushes against the sandstone, creating the lopsided effect, while the top layer is a sand and gravel aquifer created by the outwash from the glacial meltwater. Considered some of the best aquifers for water quality, this formation can be up to 300 feet thick, though it thins out and disappears in the parts of the driftless area that were not fed by rivers and other outflows. Supplying water for wells and cool trout streams, groundwater is used extensively for irrigation and municipal needs, and is a vital part of Wisconsin's water resources. Unfortunately, due to their porousness, the dolomite aquifers are particularly vulnerable to contamination. From the eastern lowlands and the southern prairies to the western valleys and the northern forests, these lake, river, wetland, and groundwater ecosystems form the symbiotic web of Wisconsin's water. The state uses a total of more than 7 billion gallons of water per day. Anything that potentially threatens this resource is a cause for serious concern. A natural force of power and variety, water remains supremely challenging to manage as Wisconsin grows. Nonetheless, this is the stage on which the scientists who monitor and attempt to mitigate the effects of mercury and other pollutants must act. In 2002, Wisconsin issued a statewide advisory regarding mercury and fish consumption for all of its inland waters. This is an issue that impacts many people. On our next podcast, we will hear from the scientists themselves who are working to solve the problems associated with water, Wisconsin, and the mercury cycle. This has been a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. This podcast was written and recorded by Chris Bocast. That's me. Other voices appearing were Buzz Kemper, Kim Murata, and Alfred House. I also wrote and performed the music, except for Outside's Turning In, which was written and performed by The Whoopers, recorded live in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and Nocturne, which was written and performed by MJ Catalan and myself. A few seconds were used of Gordon Lightfoot, The Byrds, and Jimi Hendrix to emphasize instructional points. This podcast is public domain. Thank you for listening.